Okay, let's unpack this. We are diving into a realm that sounds like the most utopian or maybe dystopian science fiction, but it's actually rooted firmly in some pretty radical philosophical proposals.
It is.
We're talking about transhumanism, but specifically the most ambitious goal you could possibly imagine, the total abolition of suffering.
Right. Not just managing it.
No, not mitigating it. We're talking about making severe pain, misery, anxiety, just biologically obsolete.
That's it. And for this deep dive, we're really analyzing the arguments of philosopher David Pearce. He's the leading proponent of what's called the hedonistic imperative.
Or HEI, for short.
Exactly, HI.
Yeah.
And our mission here is to synthesize his blueprints, because these aren't just hopes. He presents them as a technical roadmap for a genetically reformed post-Darwinian future.
And the core thesis is it's just brutally uncompromising. Pearce argues that biological genetic intervention offers the only long-term structural solution.
Right. He doesn't pull any punches.
Not at all. He flatly calls Darwinian life a monstrous engine of inconceivable horrors.
Which really sets a high bar for intervention, doesn't it?
An incredibly high bar. The claim is that our ancient signaling system, the whole pleasure-pain axis, it's just barbaric.
And if we have the tools to upgrade it, we have a moral obligation to do it. The ultimate goal, as he puts it, is replacing that entire axis with a pleasure super pleasure axis.
What does that actually look like practically? I mean, how do you replace pain with something that's still useful?
Well, it would result in a civilization that's underpinned by what he calls information-sensitive gradients of intelligent bliss.
Okay, break that down for us.
So think of it this way. Right now, you touch something hot, you feel pain. It's coarse, it's destructive, it's disabling. In this new system, you'd still get a functional signal, a gradient of displeasure, maybe, but it would never, ever cross that threshold into real coercive suffering.
So it's like a sophisticated warning light, not a catastrophic five-alarm fire.
Exactly. Disappointment, boredom. They would become literally physiologically impossible.
Gradients of intelligent bliss. It's like optimizing the human OS for perpetual engagement. So, okay, let's move from the philosophy to the mechanics. How do we build this hyperthymic civilization?
Well, the sources really emphasize that, thanks to modern biotech, fixing suffering isn't a utopian fantasy anymore.
It's becoming a real policy option.
It's rapidly becoming a policy option.
Yeah.
And the core technical goal is to ratchet up the default hedonic range and set points worldwide.
So just raising everyone's baseline happiness to a naturally high level, what you'd call hyperthymia.
Precisely. But this isn't just about general gene therapy. He's very specific about the targets. He points to identifiable genes that act as these crucial control points.
Right, like a volume knob.
Exactly. He highlights the SCN9A gene, which he colorfully dubs the volume knob for pain. If you can safely regulate that, physical pain just becomes a manageable, informative signal.
And what about psychological pain? Because that's arguably the bigger burden for many people.
He addresses that too. He focuses on the FAAH and FAAHOU genes for that, for mental pain, for psychological distress.
And this is where the theory intersects with reality, right? The sources bring up the case of Joe Cameron to prove this is already possible.
Exactly. Jo Cameron is a fascinating case study. She's a genetic outlier with this rare dual mutation in those very genes.
And the result is.
The result is she's functionally immune to most severe pain, anxiety, and depression. She can get burns, cuts, and not even realize it, but she also maintains this constantly elevated positive mood.
Wait, immune to severe pain and chronic depression? That sounds like a biological cheat code for life.
It does, doesn't it?
But how does someone like that manage danger signals if you don't feel that urgency of pain?
And that's why she's such a powerful example. Her functional discernment isn't lost. She still senses danger. She pays attention. What's been abolished is the suffering that goes with the warning.
So the sources argue that suffering is it's genetically optional. It's not actually required for high performance.
That's the core argument. And it's backed up by people like Anders Sandberg, who was another person mentioned.
The philosopher who has a ridiculously high hedonic set point.
That's him. He says he finds it genuinely difficult to stay sad, even at funerals. But crucially, these people, these hyperthymic individuals, they're not zoned out pleasure seekers.
No, they're described as passionate, functional, deeply engaged people.
Life lovers. They've just lost the capacity for severe misery.
So the idea isn't to create compliant drones, it's to optimize for effective, passionately driven individuals. But Let's bring this back to you, the listener. What does this mean for how we approach having children?
It forces a profound ethical inversion. The argument is that as germline editing becomes precise and available, the ethical question just flips on its head.
It's no longer about whether I would give up my suffering.
No. The question becomes, are we entitled to inflict a genetic vulnerability to coercive misery, to severe depression, anxiety, chronic pain on others?
On our future children.
On our children. So choosing to have kids the old-fashioned way, yeah. Knowing you could have edited out those vulnerabilities.
This recast as morally reckless.
That's the powerful and, yes, highly controversial claim. It suggests procreation becomes a moral choice about preventing harm.
And that strong focus on harm reduction leads us right into the philosophical engine driving this whole thing, negative utilitarianism.
Right, or NU. It's the ethical position that strictly, absolutely prioritizes preventing suffering over maximizing bliss.
Okay, so classical utilitarianism, CU, is about making the total good in the world as high as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But NU's goal, the non-negotiable one, is to get rid of everything below what he calls hedonic zero.
Exactly. It's about fixing the worst problems first, period. And the sources use some pretty provocative thought experiments to show why CU can seem, well, insane.
Such as?
Well, imagine a scenario where classical utilitarianism is forced, in theory, to accept an exponentially greater amount of suffering for one person.
If it leads to a super exponential increase in pleasure for a million others.
Yes. CU just does the math. It maximizes the total. And you would never, ever allow that one person's astronomical suffering to happen, no matter how much bliss it might purchase for others.
So for the philosopher, the ethical weight always, always falls on stopping the suffering.
Always. Suffering is the ultimate moral evil. The sources even pose these hypotheticals where CU is obliged to, say, destroy a blissful civilization with a shockwave if it somehow maximized total cosmic utility over the next billion years.
It's a purely mathematical cold calculation.
It is.
And yet, despite being philosophically NU and admitting he'd be relieved if the world just painlessly ended to stop suffering, Pierce specifically argues against apocalyptic solutions.
And that's the critical practical constraint. He focuses exclusively on the biotech fix, on genome reform. That's the ethical path forward.
Which allows him to maintain that moral priority of NU while still supporting the sanctity of life in law. It's an abolitionist movement, not an extinctionist one.
Precisely.
And speaking of all life, the project's scope extends way beyond humans into what's called the pan-species welfare state.
This is where it gets truly audacious. High-tech Jainism, some call it.
The scope is planetary.
It's planetary. It starts with the most avoidable suffering. So animal agriculture is identified as maybe the single worst source of severe avoidable suffering on Earth.
So the call is to outlaw it and move to cruelty-free cultured meat.
Immediately. That part is, well, it's controversial, but it's straightforward. But then we move into the truly radical domain.
Intervening in the natural world to mitigate wild animal suffering.
Yes. This is compassionate stewardship on a scale we've never even imagined. We're talking about large-scale, deliberate intervention in the biosphere.
Like what specifically?
Like genetically herbivorizing predators.
I have to stop you there. Genetically herbivorizing a lion.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like ecological engineering on a scale that could destroy entire ecosystems, mm-hmm. even with the best intentions. How do the sources even begin to address that complexity?
They acknowledge it's an enormous task, yeah. a multi-generational project. But they argue it's a moral imperative.
Mm.
And they suggest using advanced tools like synthetic gene drives.
To do what?
To spread benign, low-pain alleles across tens of thousands of free-living species.
Even if that allele carries a modest fitness cost, wouldn't that be, interfering with natural selection?
The abolitionist position is that nature's mechanisms are fundamentally cruel and must be replaced by compassionate design. The priority is reducing suffering.
So it's a complete rejection of preserving the natural order, and this whole project is then connected directly to existential risk, to X risk.
He argues that the biology of suffering is itself a fundamental X risk. He points to the roughly 800,000 annual suicides worldwide.
And his question is?
His question is provocative. How many of those individuals operating from a place of intense nihilistic pain would take the rest of the world down with them if they had access to, say, WMDs or advanced AI?
In other words, suffering is the fuel for nihilistic destruction.
Exactly. The conclusion is that a suffering-free civilization of passionate life lovers, people who are hardwired to cherish life, would just be safer in every single measurable sense.
Okay, that wraps up the biological and ethical plan for the organic world. Let's turn now to the final piece, the architecture of mind. How does he view intelligence itself? Specifically, the relationship between digital AI and the biological mind.
This takes us into some deep philosophy of mind, and he has a very controversial position. He calls it the AI zombie thesis.
Digital zombies, that is a loaded term. What does that imply about, you know, the state-of-the-art systems we see today, like LLMs?
It implies they're cognitively crippled.
Yeah.
The claim is that classical digital computers, Turing machines, are fundamentally and invincibly ignorant of the empirical realm.
The realm of pleasure, pain, subjective experience?
Yes. They process information, but they experience nothing.
Why invincible, though? Why can't we just scale up a model until it finally wakes up?
The barrier, he argues, is architectural. It's not about computational power. The core mechanism that AI lacks is something called phenomenal binding.
Okay, we need a metaphor here. That sounds highly technical.
Think of consciousness as a symphony orchestra. You have all the separate sections, violins for vision, percussion for motor commands, and so on.
Right.
A classical digital system is like a perfect spreadsheet, listing every single note being played, the volume, the location of every player. It has all the data. But phenomenal binding, that is the experience of the actual music.
The unified, seamless sound.
The music that gives meaning to all the individual parts. Current AI can build a spreadsheet, but it can never, ever hear the music.
That's a powerful distinction. And the sources tie this to physics, right?
They do. It's connected to something called decoherence. Decoherence is what makes classical computing work so cleanly. That same mechanism, he argues, simultaneously prevents classical computers from supporting the kind of coherence needed for a mind.
So if digital AI is architecturally barred from waking up, what does that mean for the future of superintelligence?
It means the future has to be biological. The goal shifts to creating full-spectrum superintelligences.
Which would be us, genetically rewritten.
Our genetically rewritten biological descendants, yeah. Augmented with AI. They'd use neurochips to access the colossal data processing of zombie AI while keeping their own organic neuronal core that supports true sentience.
So we don't upload consciousness. We just, we augment and elevate the existing organic hardware to harness digital power.
Precisely. This biological post-human path is the only way, in this view, to access what he calls billions of alien state spaces of consciousness, latent in matter and energy.
Spaces that are computationally inaccessible to digital systems.
Exactly. The enterprise of knowledge, according to this roadmap, has barely even begun.
Okay, so let's synthesize the sheer scope of this. We've gone from genetically dialing up happiness with the FAAH gene to rewriting the laws of nature in the Serengeti, all while defining digital AI as fundamentally inert. It's an immense vision.
It is. And it faces monumental political and sociological resistance.
Of course. The challenge is enormous because when you talk about germline reform, you immediately invite the historical shadow of the E-word eugenics.
And the fear of enforced uniformity. Absolutely. Is this the bio-meaning revolution where we ethically redesign ourselves to be incapable of cruelty? Or is it, you know, a terrifying step toward controlling the deepest parts of our experience? That ambiguity is the central hurdle.
So what's the final takeaway on his confidence in this whole abolitionist project?
His confidence is really rooted in the technology.
Mm-hmm.
He maintains that if in a few hundred years suffering still exists, it won't be because it was too hard to get rid of.
It will be because we chose it.
It will be because our successors actively chose to conserve it, to cling to what he sees as this archaic, cruel evolutionary legacy. The technical barriers are falling. The only obstacle left is our own status quo bias.
That reframes everything. And that leads us to our final provocative thought for you, the listener. Imagine you could communicate with a civilization far more advanced than ours, and their lives were underpinned entirely by these genetically programmed gradients of intelligent bliss. Their existence is defined by passion, joy, and utility, but there's zero capacity for true misery. Would you, in good conscience, urge them to revert to ancestral horrors just to regain their humanity?
And what does our own deeply embedded defense of suffering really suggest about our own biases toward the way things are now?